ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green here for The Country Hour again this week. In just a moment, more on the measures being taken to try and keep potato mop top virus from getting a foothold on the mainland after it was detected in Tasmania some weeks back. Also coming up, if China's interested in again taking Australian canola, how significant could that be for growers?
It's incredibly important this year because our largest typical buyer, Europe, they've had a much larger crop this year, going from 16 to 19 million tonnes. So Europe won't need as much locally. We're really in a place where we do need another buyer. And if that buyer is China, that's really good news.
That's to come in this next half an hour. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with me throughout the program, my talkback number is 1300 160222 or the text line is 0467 922 783. Well, first to the potato mop top virus. It's a biosecurity threat that Australia's mainland is still very worried about. In fact, the mainland industry is so worried about it, they've asked Biosecurity Tasmania to allow them to send back seed potatoes sent from the island state, whether contaminated or not. The concern is that export markets are at stake if there's even a sniff of mop top on mainland Australia. Dr. Nigel Crump from AusPicker, the Independent Seed Potato Certification Authority, gave Warwick Long this update.
We've continued to do the surveillance on the potatoes that came across. There was about 632 tonnes that came across the mainland, mostly into South Australia and Victoria. And in a couple of those consignments, we've actually detected the virus there. And as you said, luckily, none of that seed had been planted. So we've managed to prevent that seed from being established into the mainland. And so far, we've stopped the virus in its tracks.
So what happens to that seed, though, that the contaminated seed?
The contaminated seed at the moment, I believe, is under a quarantine, issued under quarantine by the Victorian government. So we're looking at how that seed's going to be either processed out or destroyed. But we're just equally concerned about the material that is here that has been tested and negative, because one thing the test does, we're using a PCR test, same as what we did with COVID, but it tests the flesh of the tuber. It doesn't test the virus is actually spread through a soil-borne fungus called Spongospora, which could be on the outside of the tuber. So if that fungus is there, it can drop off, go into the soil, and then contaminate the soil into the future. So we're equally concerned about, given that the endemic nature, as you said in the intro there, about the disease in Tasmania, we're equally concerned about any of the seed and soil sources coming out of Tasmania.
So is it your hope that all of that seed then gets destroyed or sent back to Tasmania?
We've really been pushing for that. We've actually written a letter to the Biosecurity Tasmania asking whether they could actually return the seed. And that'll be interesting because Tasmania has a interesting biosecurity where they don't have any movement of potatoes going from the mainland.
So you're not allowed to send it back?
We're not allowed to send it back. Generally, typically in the past, we haven't been able to send it back and we're not allowed to send anything down there. And that's their biosecurity, and that's for potato cyst nematode and a few other things. So we're in the process of asking that. We're also lobbying governments here, Victorian and South Australian governments, to see what we can do about that seed that's here, to see if we can avoid having this problem. Because we've got a large export market that's going into Indonesia and Thailand, and those countries don't want mop top either. And we've tested all that seed that's gone across there this year, over 1,500 tonnes. We still haven't been able to find the virus, so we want to keep it that way.
So you've got a question over the seed that's come from Tasmania here, even if it has been tested due to the type of testing there is. There are export markets at stake here. It seems like there's a lot on the line.
Certainly, and it's always a case of biosecurity, and prevention is better than cure. So I think that's what we're going to apply here, is making sure we maintain our biosecurity. And, eventually we may find this disease on the mainland, but at this stage we've got to go with the evidence and the science and say that it's not here and try and protect our industry.
What has Tasmania said, Biosecurity Tasmania has said, when you've asked them to take the seed back?
At this stage, we're waiting for a response from them. So we just got acknowledgement of our letter that we sent down there, but we're waiting for that response to come through. And we need that response fairly quickly because it is planting time. So growers are making decisions about what they're going to do about their seed stocks.
And I'd imagine until such decision is made on either the suspect seed or the or the seed that has been cleared but has some question marks over it, growers can't get compensation or can't decide what to do with it? And does that cost them money?
It does. At the moment, that's the real uncertainty. So growers would, I think most growers I've spoken to, we had a meeting with over 80 growers back on the 3rd of October, and all the growers there voted not to plant the seed. But a lot of them are looking at big costs of that seed.
There are we talking tens of thousands of dollars here? Or
hundreds of thousands in some cases, you know, so it could be significant loss if growers decide not to plant. But there is an owner reimbursement cost under the emergency pest deed, and that needs to be triggered under Ausveg. The growers have been paying 10 cents a tonne for that levy since 2018, so that money is being accumulated there, and, you know, it should be used in these sort of situations.
What has Ausveg said about that?
I think there's a meeting on the 18th, and they're trying to work through the process to work out how it gets triggered. But it's, from what I understand, it's a very complicated process, but I think that's why we have this deed. We have this deed so that it can be triggered for these sort of events. But it just, we need to get that quickly to growers. We can't have, you know, months and months on decision making.
Yeah, it's planting time now, and it feels like all of this is moving slowly.
Well, you've got to remember the detection occurred in July and, you know, some months ago, so we had time to make decisions. But that window is closing, and that's why it's important to get these decisions happening quicker. It's the same on the diagnostics front. We've got labs that are turning around tests within 2 to 3 days so growers can make informed decisions. But we need the same thing with the policy. And so we're really calling on Ausveg and all the government agencies involved to trigger this deed so that we can get on with doing what growers do, growing quality potatoes.
How open is the window for planting? When does that close?
Well, it's closing as we speak, really, because growers are in full swing planting right across the state and into South Australia as well. So it's a busy time for everyone. So, you know, in the next few weeks, yeah, we need these decisions to be made.
What's the timeline then from here?
Timeline here, there's an industry meeting happening on the 18th that Ausveg is calling, and that's bringing all the states together to look at the future directions and see if we can harmonise trade. But other than that, I'm not too sure how we're going to pull this off. We've written to everyone we can write to, the state minister, federal minister and the like, but we really do need to get some action happening.
A massive announcement for a potato processing facility near Horsham at Doom was made this week. State government support, $250 million chip manufacturing facility for Farm Fritz, a Dutch company, to build a site there. What does that mean for the potato industry? Does that mean future investment is looking good?
Look, I think it's exciting for our industry that we're getting this investment. So we've had the Farm Fritz announcement in Horsham, and we've also recently had the Pepsi make the announcement. They've purchased the Dowling Agritech business in South Australia, which is one of our large seed producers. So it's actually quite exciting that there is this multinational investment in our industry, and it shows there's a bright future, and the quality of the potatoes that are being grown by our growers is internationally recognised.
That's Dr. Nigel Crump there from AusPicker, the Independent Seed Potato Certification Authority. He was speaking there to Warwick Long. It's 13 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green today. Well, farmers who are looking for a more accurate record of localised rainfall, there is a new app that's been designed to help producers get a greater insight into rainfall information specific to your property. It's been developed at Federation University. The Rainfall Mapper merges the information from the BOM's rainfall gauges and radar data and allows users to select areas of up to 500 by 500 metres for specific locations and time periods. The creators, Dr. Peter Weir, with the university's e-research and digital innovation unit, he says this tool will help farmers to make more informed decisions, including crop planning and irrigation strategies.
Traditionally, we measure point-based with rain gauges, so they only represent in the area of rain that they collect is about that of a small dinner plate. By taking this application to merge rainfall with weather radar, we're able to look at a whole area. In this particular case, it's an area of 500 metres by 500 metres. This is already a product that Bureau of Meteorology have been generating for some time. It's called Rainfields 3. And it's publicly available, but it's very hard to interpret the data. It's 15-minute interval data, and it's stored on the National Computing Infrastructure Database, so it's not user-friendly at all. So what I have done is turned it into a user-friendly product in the form of this rainfall mapper app. What it is able to do is give a spatial indication of the rainfall falling in a chosen area. So the user is able to select an area by a rectangle on the app, and the app is then able to, and between two points in time, so the app then is able to go and look up the amount of rainfall that has actually fallen in that square, if you like.
So what are some of the practical benefits for farmers?
Well, it gives them a much better indication of spatial distribution of moisture on their paddock, because they're looking at all the rain that's fallen in that area. There may be some inaccuracies in the type of measurement, but it's certainly a lot more indicative of what's going on, as been reported by a lot of anecdotal evidence. With a lot of the localised intense thunderstorms we have, particularly or we've experienced in previous years around the Wimmera, they've actually been totally missed by the rain gauges, because the bomb rain gauges are 30 to 50 kilometres apart and the storm cell may only be 30 kilometres across. So in the records that are in the recordings of the gauges, just do not indicate what's going on. So what this product is able to do is to infill that rainfall and look at it from a spatial point of view. And that seems to have sparked a lot of interest amongst farmers.
So the Bureau of Meteorology has been under scrutiny, certainly recently, but over a number of years now. Farmers are saying that they don't necessarily trust that the information coming out of the Bureau of Meteorology is accurate. So can farmers trust this app?
It has got disclaimers in it that I'm a consumer of the data and not a producer of the data. There are inherent possible inaccuracies in using merged radar and rainfall data, but of course it's been approached in a fairly scientific way to generate spatial merged data using selected rain gauges. They don't use all the rain gauges in an area, but that's not my remit. You'd have to speak to the Bureau about that. At the same time, it's very indicative of what's actually happening spatially in the landscape.
If a farmer's interested in searching a certain time period, is that a possibility?
Yes. It depends on the way where the data's been set up. Some of the radars, weather radars, are only around 2 years old, so obviously they can't go back much further than that, but some of them have been around for much longer than that. The data that covers most of the rain-fed cropping regions of Australia, something like 70-odd radar units, which we can access the data, they can choose from 24 hours. They can look at, say, a whole season's worth of data for a specified area, but there are constraints on the size of the area that they choose at the moment. You know, you can't choose half the state. The amount of data you create was just impossible.
It's a bit more specific than that, yeah.
Yeah, from looking at it from a paddock point of view, the use that it's been experienced so far, people have found it extremely helpful and interesting to look at what's happened, how much has been accumulated, say, on the paddock, and whether there are wetter areas than others. And that gives them the impetus to go and maybe do some more investigation to see if that is valid.
And to that point, as the weather patterns change and are less predictable, what role does an app like this play?
The more we get these localised intense thunderstorms, the more useful this becomes, because, as I mentioned before, the gauges are too far apart to pick up the detail. If you think of a rain gauge as roughly the size of a small dinner plate, that's the only area that is actually being measured. If you take all of the Bureau of Meteorology rain gauges that cover the whole of Australia and work out the area of each one of those, it's equivalent to about the area of a tennis court. So it is very much this problem of taking point measurements in a highly chaotic event, because the rainfall is one of the most challenging meteorological variables to measure or model, because of its randomness, especially in these localised thunderstorms, which, you know, the data is only really available on the radar, and then merging it with the rain gauge data helps make it more accurate.
That's Dr. Peter Weir there. He's a researcher at Federation Uni's Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation, and he was speaking with Jane McNaughton. If you're interested in being part of the trial and checking the app out, you can head to the Federation Uni website and look for the Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation section. It's just going on 20 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
The formal resumption of Australia's canola trade to China would be an incredible gain for Australian farmers. Now, if you were listening into The Country Hour last week, brought you the story of a ship in WA that was being loaded with 65,000 tonne of canola bound for Qingdao in northeast China's Shandong province. It's the first time in 5 years that we've sent a shipment of canola to China, and this one is a trial. Well, Commonwealth Bank ag economist Denis Voskaneski says that if the trial shipment's a success, it could help support prices for the oilseed.
Fingers crossed that that shipment sails smoothly and we have then further shipments coming from Australia into Canada. It's incredibly important this year because our largest typical buyer, Europe, they've had a much larger crop this year, going from 16 to 19 million tonnes. So Europe won't need as much locally. We're really in a place where we do need another buyer. And if that buyer is China, that's really good news. So look, fingers crossed that everything goes fine with that shipment and we can send more. I am really watching closely what happens between Canada and China. There's a lot of meetings, not much progress at this point, but things could change tomorrow. So with these shipments, you got to keep in mind that even if there are large purchases, whether it's from us or from the US in the past, there have been times where those shipments have been cancelled. And that's what we've got to keep an eye on.
It really does sound like quite a volatile hold your breath moment by the sound of things.
Well, yeah, it feels like it's been that way since COVID. Markets become incredibly volatile. And when you have markets driven more by politics as opposed to typical supply and demand, you really have to be switched on and on the ball constantly.
China was a really significant customer for Australian canola before that trade was shut. If they were to resume that position and the door to trade was to formally open beyond these trials, what would that mean in terms of potential price influence on the ground?
It would definitely be supportive. Historically, because the demand from Europe has really been government driven, and when I say that, it's been to create, our canola has been used to crush, and then the oil has been going towards biofuel. And that biofuel, the amount they need to make, is really driven by the European Union. So Europe has always been offering us a really high price, and that's been supporting the demand for our canola now for a very long time. Having China as an additional buyer would just support those prices and that demand further. China historically, yes, has been a very large buyer before the ceasing of our purchases. So it would only be good news if China was back.
If I had some canola to sell, you'd really be feeling a bit anxious, wouldn't you? Because it sounds like it could go rapidly one way or the other if China and Canada sort out their problems. And there's all this soy coming in from the US, and that could have a negative impact on pricing. But then if the market reopens to China formally between Australia and China, then that could push things up the other way. It really sounds like it's at a real sort of fork in the road.
Look, at this point, you have larger production in Europe. Canada, when I was there earlier in the year, it was a bit dry. When I was leaving, this was around June, July, it started raining. It never really stopped. They ended up having a decent crop. They're typically our largest competitor. So overall, there before the announcement that China is back, there wasn't any substantial reason for large upside in canola. It was just more likely you're just going to track the way it has been more flatlined. But now with China back, if they do stick around, it would be supportive of canola prices. And I think even the thought of that has been holding up canola prices more than otherwise it would have been. So from the perspective of what do you look for? Well, if China stays in the market, that should be supportive. We have two large buyers then, Europe and China. If they renege on the current contracts, that's of course something to watch on the downside.
That is Denis Voskaneski there. He is an agricultural economist with Commonwealth Bank, and he was speaking to Joe Prendergast. If you want to read more about that story of that shipment of canola heading to China, it was loaded last week over in WA. Just search for ABC China and canola and you'll find it. Or go to abc.net.au/rural. Well, also last week we were talking about how widespread Gazania is. You might be seeing plenty of those flowering on roadsides and in paddocks at the moment, but another weed that you might be seeing more of also at the moment is the purple of Salvation Jane, which we're told is seeing something of a resurgence. Well, like everything, the weed suffered from drought conditions last year, meaning its usual biocontrols did not get the chance to breed. Landscape officer from the Northern and York Landscape Board, Morgan McCallum, says the controls need a good season of Salvation Jane to re-establish, so you can expect the purple weeds to be sticking around for a little while longer.
There is definitely a lot more Salvation Jane around in the region at the moment. I know just driving around and visually I've been seeing a lot more than what I've seen in years. So it's a bit like back in the day when we were kids, you would see like paddocks of Salvation Jane. You don't really see that anymore. And now it's sort of in paddocks on roadsides and yeah, it's sort of everywhere at the moment.
Have the plants themselves, were they impacted by the drought and now they're coming back, or why is there more now?
So we have worked really hard in the over the past years releasing biocontrols and getting those up and going. And last year, as we know, was drought conditions. Some areas were driest on record. And because of that, a lot of Salvation Jane didn't come up, didn't germinate, which means the biocontrols didn't have a season to breed and produce. So this year we've seen Salvation Jane come back with all the winter rain that we received, but the biocontrols are in lower numbers because of that. So they really need a good Salvation Jane season to recoup the bug numbers, basically.
So what kind of biocontrols are there that normally impact Salvation Jane?
So the most common ones in the Northern York region are the crown and root weevil, and you'd find those pretty well anywhere in our region, and they're fairly easy to find. So you can look for shoot holes in the plant, and if you can give them a bit of a shake with a white board underneath, you'd see them fall onto the white bit of board. So the biocontrol really thrives with the Salvation Jane or dies with Salvation Jane in terms of the population numbers. So we would expect next season for the biocontrols to be increased in numbers and doing their job a lot better than they're doing this year. So the numbers are just a bit down last year because there wasn't much around last season.
Why is that bad? Like, what does Salvation Jane do to the environment and to livestock?
Well, in terms of agriculture and livestock, it'll outcompete any of your good feed that you have in the paddocks. I mean, it's not the best feed as a whole. So something to keep in mind with Salvation Jane is it can be toxic to some animals. So things like horses, it'll be quite toxic too. But sheep and cattle are only a little bit susceptible to the toxicity. They'd have to graze a lot of it for it to be an issue. But yeah, it would outcompete your feed, but it also outcompetes native veg on the side of the roads and things like that as well.
So should graziers be doing anything to try and control it, or it's just kind of we'll have to wait till next season?
I think for now, wait till next season and see what happens. And yeah, I mean, you can definitely go and spray it. That is no problem at all. And a lot of people that are cropping would have already done their sprays and things like that. But we would expect next season for there to be decreased amounts of Salvation Jane around. If you want any more information, you can definitely get in contact with any of your Northern York officers, and we're happy to chat to anyone about it.
Morgan McCallum there from the Northern and York Landscape Board talking to Isabella Kelly about the prevalence of Salvation Jane. Like the gazanias, quite pretty to look at in the paddocks, but yeah, a pest. So something we'll have to get rid of. It's 27 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green. Let's head to the Weather Bureau. Hannah Marsh is our forecaster today. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Selena.
What's the story as we start off another week?
Well, we've got a high-pressure system to the south of Perth, and that's extending a ridge over South Australia, but also maintaining a southwesterly airstream over the south. So with that onshore airstream, we have seen cloud about the southern half of the state. It is starting to break up and contract south, and we haven't seen any rainfall associated with that since 9 a.m. this morning. We will have an embedded cold front in that southwesterly airstream, which will just clip the southern coasts as we head towards the late afternoon and evening period and overnight, which will just see an increase in that shower activity about the agricultural area. In terms of maximum temperatures so far, it's ranged from 12 degrees at Mount Lofty up to 27 degrees at Moomba. As we head into tomorrow, that shower activity about the southern agricultural area will contract to the lower southeast coast by early afternoon. There is also the possibility of seeing some showers and possibly thunderstorms developing in the far northwest of the state tomorrow afternoon. As having a look at some of the temperatures for tomorrow, we're looking at 21 and partly cloudy for Ceduna, Port Lincoln 18 and mostly sunny, Cooper Pedy 28 and mostly sunny, getting up to 27 at Roxby Downs, 31 for Oodnadatta, 23 with cloud clearing at Renmark, 19 with an early shower or two at Murray Bridge, 18 with cloud clearing for Clare, Mount Barker 17 with a morning shower or two, Victor Harbour 17 also with a shower or two, Kingscote 19 and partly cloudy, and Mount Gambier just 14 degrees with a shower or two. Then as we move into Wednesday, that high pressure system continues to move to the east. We see that shower activity about the south really just contract to the lower southeast coast and then clear during the morning. But we do have a trough that'll move into the far west of the state on Wednesday, and that'll see that shower and thunderstorm activity about the northwest of the state gradually extend southwards and eastwards over Thursday and Friday. Having a look at the cumulative rainfall totals that we're expecting up until the end of Friday, we're generally looking at less than 2 millimetres about the northeast pastoral district, 2 to 10 millimetres about the northern agricultural area, 2 to 5 millimetres about the northern agricultural area, 2 to 10 millimetres about the west coast, southern agricultural area and the far northwest of the state. Then we could see some isolated falls of 10 to 30 millimetres about the southern agricultural area and parts of the west and far northwest, mainly with thunderstorms. The other thing to mention, particularly on Wednesday morning, with that high pressure system over us, we could see some areas of frost about the agricultural area on Wednesday morning.
Thanks, Hannah. Have a great rest of your Monday.
Thank you. Same to you and your listeners.
Hannah Marsh there, our forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, for Tuesday, the upper western district, a sunny day forecast there with south to southwesterly winds, 15 to 20 k's an hour, increasing to 25 to 35 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures between 11 and 15 degrees. During the day, they should reach between 25 and 31 degrees. For the lower western district, mostly sunny tomorrow with a slight chance of a shower near the Victorian border in the morning, but near zero chance of rain elsewhere. Southwesterly winds 15 to 20 k's an hour. They'll pick up to 25 to 40 k's an hour in the morning before turning southerlies 15 to 25 k's an hour in the evening. Overnight temperatures between 7 and 11 degrees. During the day, they should reach the low to mid 20s. It's closer to 28 minutes to one here on the Country Hour.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to have your company on this Monday. Coming up in this next half an hour, well, a South Australian is now heading up a very exclusive group that represents the world's greatest wine-producing regions. And yes, South Australia is considered one of them. And you'll also hear a very special message from the one and only Jimmy Barnes for South Australia's grain farmers. That's all coming up after we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the state's transport minister has defended legalising e-scooters on roads. Last week, a man died in a collision between the e-scooter he was riding and a car. However, Emily Burke says the regulations are important and that there'll be a review once they've been in place for a year. A man has been arrested in relation to fraud offences in and around the Streaky Bay area. It's alleged that on Sunday, police stopped a white station wagon with a Victorian licence plate on the Eyre Highway. Police say they received information the vehicle had been involved in fraud offences, with the driver allegedly stopping other motorists claiming that he needed cash for fuel, with the man willing to trade gold jewellery in exchange for money. And the AFL has announced it's introducing a wild card round from next year, with two games taking place over the weekend currently set aside for the pre-finals bye. The wildcard round will give 7th placed finishers the chance to take on 10th place and 8th place take on 9th. The AFL has confirmed it will implement the change in the coming days when it also releases the 2026 fixture. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. And a text that's come through, we were just talking about Salvation Jane. A text that says the weed bridal creeper should be targeted. So gazanias, Salvation Jane, bridal creeper, these things have all got lovely names, but they're an absolute pest. So what else are you seeing growing rampant at the moment? Is there anything else, any other weeds that you're seeing lots of around the place? That text line is 0467 922 783. Or you can always give me a call on 1300 160 222. Well, as I said there earlier, this is great news for South Australia because what are the regions of Bordeaux in France, America's Napa Valley, Verona in Italy and South Australia all have in common? Well, they all make some of the best wine in the world, are all members of an exclusive global network called Global Wine Capitals. That network has a brand new president elected over the weekend at its AGM and conference in France, and that president is South Australian. It's Jo Collins, Executive Director of Industry Strategy and Partnerships at PIRZA, and she'll be taking on the presidential role for the next 2 years. Jo, great to have your company and welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks very much, Selena. Thanks for having me.
And I understand you've pretty much just stepped off a plane from France after your appointment.
I have. It's been a really busy week, but a really fantastic week as well. And it's been really good for South Australia, and we've had a really fantastic delegation travelling as well. So we had representatives from the South Australian Wine Industry Association, also from the Australian Wine Research Institute, Adelaide Uni, Adelaide Hills Wine Region, and also DrinkWise with us as well. So it's been terrific.
Now, you have now a two-year appointment as president of this Global Wine Capitals. For those who haven't heard of it, just explain what essentially it is.
Sure. So it's a network of wine regions across the globe. It was actually established back in 1999 out of Bordeaux by the Chamber of Commerce, really with the vision to create this network where it would be built on the foundation of collaboration versus competition. So really where we can get together and learn from one another and share knowledge and really raise the industry on a global scale. And from 1999, it's now a thriving alliance of 11 wine regions from across the globe.
And one of those is Adelaide. And I understand you were there from the very beginning of South Australia establishing a chapter and getting a seat at the table.
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 2016, we were unanimously voted into the network, which is fantastic. And I guess there's a number of criteria involved in how you can be a part of the network. And first of all, you need to be a renowned wine producing region, both in quality of the wine that you produce, but also in terms of your wine tourism offering as well. And they really look at the infrastructure that's in place that supports innovation as well. So South Australia is home to, you know, leading research and education institutions. As I mentioned, we have the AWRI, we have SARDI, the Adelaide University, and we're also home to National Wine Centre and major industry organisations as well.
And you're in some illustrious company there. There's some, when you're looking at the list of names of regions that are part of this alliance, it is a sort of a who's who of making the best wines in the world.
It is, absolutely it is. So I started in Bordeaux, but again, we stand alongside Napa and Porto and Mendoza in Argentina and Mainz in Germany and, 11 wine regions, really magnificent wine regions from across the globe.
So why is it important for Adelaide or for South Australia to be represented in an alliance like this? Obviously, the wine industry is facing some significant headwinds and some challenges. What sort of benefit does it bring to be part of an alliance like this when we're looking at the future?
Look, it's really important we're a part of it. Obviously, it's fantastic in terms of being positioned globally amongst the world's very best. But in terms of, you know, as you mentioned, the challenges that the industry faces at the moment, we have declining consumption and global oversupply. There's challenges with social license and with climate challenges and sustainability. And those things are shared challenges that absolutely called for shared solutions. And they're the types of things that we can work collectively on together. And just some examples, since we've been a part of the network in 2016, we have had some significant challenges that we've faced. Fires, for example, back in 2019-20, we were able to call upon Napa, who connected in with us and really shared the way in which that they had responded to their fires. And soon after, they were in a similar situation, and we had some 200 winemakers connecting up with the AWRI and Adelaide University to learn, you know, how we managed the fires here in South Australia, particularly in relation to smoke taint. But, you know, other opportunities as well. In COVID, when we were all in shutdown, we were able to connect up virtually and learn more from what each region was doing to navigate those challenges. And we also do other things like food and wine collaborations, and a perfect example of that was a collaboration we did with New Zealand in Hawke's Bay for their food and wine country celebration, where Callum Hann went over there and was engaged in that opportunity as well. So it'd be a really important network.
Jo, what do you see your role now as president for the next couple of years? Do you sort of have some goals and some key challenges and things you need to achieve?
Yeah, look, you know, I think that there is opportunity over the next couple of years, and we obviously want to continue to champion the Best of Wine Tourism proposition that we have and how we continue to promote the Best of globally. Again, looking at how we can have that greater collaboration on some of those really key issues that we're all facing at the moment. And for us, you know, we've got some really great flagship programs ourselves that we really want to strengthen. One of those is the Outbound Knowledge Exchange program, which sees people from the industry going out to all areas of the network. We've just recently announced 8 recipients this year that will travel to Hawke's Bay, Napa, Porto and Bordeaux and go and gain the knowledge from viticulture to marketing to all aspects of the wine industry, and then bringing that knowledge back to South Australia and sharing that more broadly. So lots of opportunities for collaboration and extending the network further over the next couple of years.
Well, Jo, thanks again for joining us on The Country Hour. Congratulations again on your appointment. Great to chat to you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Selena. Thanks for having me.
Jo Collins, the new president of Global Wine Capitals. She's also executive director of industry strategy and partnership at PIRZA, and she's been serving as vice president for the last couple of years. So great to have a South Australian at the helm of that very prestigious network. And as Jo Collins mentioned there, 8 members of South Australia's wine industry are preparing to travel around the world as part of a knowledge exchange. The Great Wine Capitals Outbound Knowledge Exchange Bursary Program has awarded the $6,000 bursaries to fund travel to one or more of the 12 great wine capitals, which alongside Adelaide include, as you heard there, America's Napa Valley, Bordeaux in France, Verona in Italy. Sarah Lavelle is the Director Consumer and Marketing Manager at Seven Hill Cellars in the Clare Valley, and she's going to be heading to Napa Valley as part of this program.
I chose San Francisco and Napa Valley thinking that for me in direct-to-consumer marketing and tourism, I've seen, you know, a big sort of challenge and decline in the Australian domestic market in previous years. And when you look at the US market in comparison, they've been through this sort of 5 years before we have, and they've come out of the other side with some really strong and sustainable business strategy and function. So for me, I felt that that was a really good area to go to.
Were there any specific problems or maybe methods that you're seeing over there that you are really looking to learn a bit more about?
There is sort of broader areas and there are sort of more targeted areas as well. So for me, I have a really strong interest in the wine club segment within the direct-to-consumer market and that sort of membership engagement. So I'm really interested in seeing what they've done around their attrition within wine clubs, the innovation that they've used, and then their consumer engagement both in person through cellar or tasting rooms, and then post-physical engagement as well. And then the other area that I was really interested in looking into was the sustainable tourism and communication within that as well. So Australia and South Australian wine industry in particular, we've seen some huge movement over here with the Sustainable Wine Growing Australia program, but we're not seeing that yet really be pushed through communication to the customer. So while there's some really fantastic work going on in the background in seeing that the winery and viticulture space is doing so much great work within sustainability, not a lot of wineries are yet communicating that well to the customer. And so I saw a real sort of challenge and opportunity there to have a look into what they're doing. California in particular is really great within that space, and they have a lot of programs set up within their member organisations to really support the members and wineries in showcasing that. They have quite a few different both state and regional member associations groups that are helping. So even things like they've got online portals for cellar door staff as to they can go through and complete training modules on how to talk to customers about industry sustainability, how to talk to customers about what the wider region is doing, what the individual wineries are doing. So there's modules and industry generic training there. There is support support there from their member association groups and that sort of thing through NAPA, that they have a lot more sort of communication just on their own pages through their tourism groups and that sort of thing as well. And there's just different modes and methods of communication that they've done really well, but the member groups or the wineries have bought into this in a really good way, and everyone really is taking part of it and taking ownership in it over there.
So are there things about the way you do it here and the way that we as an industry do it here that you think you'll be able to share with the Napa Valley wineries?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some great things happening over here, specifically in the actual winery and viticulture space. There's some absolutely fantastic work going on both within the Clare Valley and the wider South Australian wine industry. I think there's some really great things coming out of South Australia right now that, yeah, we'll definitely talk about and see if there are commonalities between what we're doing and what they are or have done in the past. And, yeah, I have no doubt that there's some things there that we'll be able to share with them.
So you're heading over in January. How long are you going to be over there for?
Just shy of 2 weeks. Don't think there's much downtime in the schedule at the moment. Yeah, you're expecting sort of, you know, hoping, as long as everyone says yes, of course, to a meeting, that, yeah, there will be probably 2 to 3 winery visits per day, and then a similar sort of expectation when meeting with the members association groups as well. I must say, the wine industry is usually pretty good. Generally, from what I've seen over here domestically, at least, everyone's really happy to share ideas and help the industry grow as a whole. So I'm hoping that the US take the same thought process.
Well, while I've got you in it anyway, could you just give us an update on how the season's going and how things are looking for you over there? I know we've got a lot of rain in the last week or so, but how's it looking?
That rain certainly has helped things. We obviously have had a very dry couple of years, so we're really watering, or have been up until recently, having to irrigate most vineyards, and it was looking like it was going to be quite a dry, hot season again. But this last bit of rain over the last fortnight has really perked things up again. So just driving around the region, even, you can see that everything's green, all the budding shoots have come out now. So yeah, it's actually looking really lovely around the region now, and it's certainly perked up the viticulture team. They're much happier and much more happy spot with where they think vintage will be now that we've had this bit of rain here. So we could still do with more. We still need to fill up the dams, but we're in a really hopeful spot for the upcoming vintage now. We've had this bit of rain and looking like there might be a bit more to come. So really hopeful for this 2026 season, and yeah, fingers crossed that everything continues.
Sarah Lavelle there from Seven Hills Cellars in the Clare Valley, speaking to Isabella Kelly. And yeah, she's heading off to the Napa Valley as part of the Outbound Knowledge Exchange Bursary Program with Global Wine Capitals. It is 13 minutes to one.
What's the only democracy in the world to have bingo rollers mandated in electoral laws? Ours, of course. Join me to investigate.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty starts tonight on ABC TV and ABC iView.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
I'm Harry Harris from Wakurna, and congratulations, Country Hour. I'm an avid listener, and don't miss it. It's just one of my go-tos every day. Thanks. Congratulations, Country Hour. Happy 80th.
80 years of The Country Hour.
Yeah, not long now until our official birthday next month. It's only a few weeks away until we can officially say we are 80 years old and very proud to be. You're with Selena Green on The Country Hour today. Well, last week I got to help reveal to you the results of this year's Harvest 100. 4 years now that Grain Producers South Australia has been running this competition for you to vote for your favourite songs to get you through harvest. Now, this year we were told 300 different songs were voted for, but the number one coveted spot went to Jimmy Barnes's Working Class Man. And Jimmy also won it back in 2022 when you all voted for Driving Wheels in at number one. Well, I actually reached out to Jimmy Barnes to see if he had anything to say about Working Class Man getting voted by South Australia's grain farmers as their top song for this very prestigious countdown. And, well, he got back to me.
Jimmy Barnes here. How you going, guys? I was so thrilled to hear that the farmers voted Working Class Man top of their Harvest 100 playlist this year. That song is important to me. This is a song written about my audience, about people just like you farmers, people who work hard, people who strive, you know, to make a living and feed their families. And then on the weekend, maybe they might kick their heels up occasionally and come out and see a band play or listen to music at home. So thank you very much, guys. I'm really proud to have my song on the top of your list. And I hope I can play for you all very soon. Cheers. All the best.
Jimmy Barnes there with a message for South Australia's grains industry, saying thank you very much for voting Working Class Man at top of this year's Harvest 100. I played Working Class Man last week when we made the announcement, so in honour of Jimmy giving back to us, he appeared on the countdown a few times with this song. Another one. This came in at number 12. You know this one.
Cigarettes to the black market man. I had the Vietnam cold turkey from the ocean to the silver city, and it's only other vets could understand about the long forgotten dark side guarantees. How there were no V-Day heroes in 1973. How we sailed in a Sydney harbor. But I couldn't kiss her. She was blind and I was home to the lucky land. Well, she was like so many more from that time on. Lives are all so empty until they found their chosen one. And their legs were often open, but their minds were always closed. And their hearts were held in fast suburban chains.
Cold Chisel, Kaysan, number 12 on your Harvest 100 for this year. We had a question come in on the text line asking where Kenny Chesney's She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy came in the Harvest song lineup. Well, you know it was in there. It came in at number 28 this year. And you never know your luck. Maybe I'll give it a spin at some point as well during the week. So I know that one's always very, very popular. You can find the Harvest 100, the Grain Producers SA's Spotify account has the whole playlist on there, 300 or so songs. So it should keep you out of trouble for a while if you want to go find it.
A standout feature of the ABC Listen app, free audiobooks. Tim Winton's unsettling and suspenseful The Writers and Casey Chambers' Just Don't Be a Kid and Other Profound Things I've Learned. Free audiobooks on the ABC Listen app.
Well, finally today, the first Nudgery Women's Lunch was held back in 2022 in Watervale in the Clare Valley, with local women gathering in the valley to connect with their peers. At the time, attendees brought with them a teacup of undisturbed soil from the land, which Auntie Minna mixed with ash and buried in a pit with native plants and manure. It was also about supporting what Auntie Angelina Harradine calls the little people, the beings in the soil who nourish our plants. Well, 3 years later, the second Nudgery Women's Lunch was held on Sunday in Watervale, starting with a ceremony at Penobscot Farm to water the mix of soils from 3 years ago for a lunch ceremony and poetry reading at the Watervale Hotel. Well, ABC News reporter Isabella Carboni was there, and she spoke with the co-owner of Watervale Hotel and Penobscot Farm, Nicola Palmer.
Penobscot Farm is an organic biodynamic farm. And so we're regenerative farmers, and we're trying to help the biome in the earth. But what we're understanding through our friendship with Auntie Angelina is that, you know, the soil was very, very different 200 years ago before white settlement. So what we were doing by asking those women to bring the soil was to try and bring all the biome that would have been everywhere in Nudgery country that has been disjointed and split up. So we ask women to go to the most undisturbed place on their properties and bring the soil from there. That got inoculated back together on the farm 3 years ago, and we've been looking after that for those 3 years since. This event today was the follow-on to that. It was to explain a little bit more of the story about the soil, because one of the things that Auntie Ange has talked about over the years is that the most important people in the world are the little people. And what she means by that is whatever's underground running around looking after the plants. Now, Steiner called them magic little gnomes that ran around under the ground. The indigenous call them the little people. And Auntie Ange has been quite famously has said that when asked, do the little people care if there's non-indigenous plants, she said the little people aren't racist. They'll look after any plant, so long as you look after them. Otherwise, they'll poison you and future generations. And it's pretty amazing that she's so bang on with something like that. So this event today was about talking about and celebrating the little people in the earth.
And today we witnessed a kind of mixing of the soil, some of the ash, and then, of course, the people who've come here before to this lunch before brought water as well. That was mixed in a pit. What's next for that concoction there?
Well, that will stay in that pit for 6 months or so. We'll keep having a look at it. I'll talk to you about the significance of that ash. At the event 3 years ago, we got everybody to put the soil into a tub down here at the hotel, and we were just about to leave. And one of my jobs to do with both of these events is to have a fire burning for 7 days in preparation. And Auntie Minna said, stop, you can't leave yet. You need ash from the 7 day fire or the spores won't grow. And, you know, I find that incredibly phenomenal that what Western science is only just working out, an Indigenous lady that's lived an unprivileged life knows it through her knowledge and knows it in her gut that that's an important thing to do, and we need to do that. We need the ash in there to help water moisture be held in there to help the biome.
As the co-owner of Watervale Hotel and Penobscot Farm, Nicola Palmer, speaking there with Isabella Carboni at the Nudgery Women's Lunch held over the weekend. That's it for me for today. Just enough time to quickly remind you that if you want to get your nominations in for the second annual South Australian Grain Industry Awards. They actually close today. So this is all about recognising individuals that have made outstanding contributions to the grains industry. There's six award categories: Grain Producer and Young Grain Producer of the Year, Innovation Award, Women in Grain Award, and the Industry Impact Award. There'll be a cash prize for the winners of each category, and the Sustainability Award winner gets a bursary. There's also your chance to nominate individuals for the South Australian Grain Industry Hall of Fame, both living and posthumous. But today, you've got to get onto the website and get those nominations in. SAGrainIndustryAwards.com.au is where you need to go. That's it for me, Selena Green. I'll be back with you tomorrow at noon to bring you more Country Hour. But it is just coming up to 1 o'clock and it is time for the news. I hope you have a great afternoon.
For many, the cost of living and financial hardship is taking its toll. ABC Radio is supporting disadvantaged and vulnerable people across Australia with ABC Gives. Donate now at abc.net.au/gives.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.